It's time for the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is the voice of the working class, Rick Smith.
And welcome, brothers, sisters, working class heroes. This is the Rick Smith Show. Thanks so much for being here. Today on the big program, lots to get to. Lots to talk about. Good day today. Today, good day. Yes, it's a good day. Did I mention good day? First thing I saw today, Donald Trump evidently admitted he didn't win. I was like, wow, it's going to be a good day. He was doing the little baby guy on Fox Hannity thing, rambling about how he got less votes in 2016, but somehow he won, and a whole bunch of stuff. And then he says, he goes on to say, we got them by surprise in 2016. It's true. In 2020, we did much better than we did in 16, he said. Shockingly, we were supposed to win easily at 64 million votes, and we got 75 million votes. We didn't win. Then he ruins it. He goes on, well, let's see what happens on that. No, you lost. You had it right to start with. You lost. You didn't win. He said that the whole thing was a shock. And I believe that. I believe he was shocked. I believe he was surprised. Here again, this is one of those moments where the truth almost got out. Almost. It didn't win. And the minions, not listening. Because understand, the Trumpers have now left Fox News, which at some point, Sean Hannity be on the street corner with his pencils, begging for donations, because they've all gone to crazier outlets. Fox News, not as crazy as now we've now turned the Republican Party into. But Trump lost. Lost. That simple. And what's interesting to me, again, the Q folks could not let this go on the Twitter sphere, could not let this go on social media, saying that, no, Donald Trump actually had 81 million votes to whatever Biden had, not zero. They pointed out in Pennsylvania, he was up by 600,000 votes on election night. Yeah, that's what happens when you count one side of the equation. When you do all of it, you bring it all together, he lost. And even he almost admitted it. That's progress. That's what I would assume, in the field of psychiatry, we would call a breakthrough. He's having a little breakthrough. He's waking up to the reality. He lost. And that a good thing. Then, Supreme Court. Wow. Supreme Court upheld for the third time the Affordable Care Act, or the dreaded Obamacare. The GOP lost their minds. I have seen two-year-olds in the cereal aisle more controlled and composed when they're told, no, you cannot have that sugary treat. No. Very angry, the GOP. Now, these are the people, remember, who stole a Supreme Court seat. These are people who sold out their word and their ideology to ram through another Supreme Court seat, only to not get their lucky charms. Now, look, I can't say the GOP is never going to file another lawsuit. I can't say that because they're committed. They are committed to destroying the ACA, and I cannot say that the Republicans aren't going to come up with another scheme, possible coup to steal health care away from millions of Americans like a Grinch at Christmas without an epiphany. But this looks like a done deal at this moment. I mean, it's got to be. Because here's the weird thing. As the Trump court has gotten more Trumpier, as our Supreme Court has gotten even more Trumpier, the Affordable Care Act, the dreaded Obamacare, cases have only grown in the margins of victory. The original case was a 5-4. John Roberts went over to the other side, traitor. 5-4 case. The next case that came up, a couple years later, 6-3. Uh-oh, because you stole the Supreme Court. You stole the seat. and now a 7-2 decision. I'll tell you, wow, surprise, 7-2. Shocked. Shocked. Shocked by the fact that the surprising part for me was Clarence Thomas. I thought Clarence Thomas followed Samuel Alito around like the dog with, you know, sniffing for treats. I really did. I thought that they were, you know, that they were like the couple. Wherever Sam went, Clarence wasn't far behind. Clarence Thomas saying, no, we're not going to destroy the Affordable Care Act. Shocked. Now, like I said, GOP lost their ever-loving freaking minds. And they threw a fit, major fit. You had Kevin McCarthy, the House GOP leader, Steve Scalise, and Elise Stefanik with their statement saying that the ruling does not change the fact that Obamacare failed to meet its promises and is hurting hardworking American families. And you go, hey, guys, question over here. Woo-hoo, me. What have you done to make it better? Because understand, and we had this conversation last night, the idea of the Affordable Care Act at the beginning was to do what we did with Medicare. Medicare was terrible when it passed. Covered very little, covered very few people, was not good, was not great, wasn't what it is now. And the idea was it was going to get progressively better. We were going to tweak it. We were going to find things that needed to be done. We're going to do it a bipartisan way because, hey, we negotiated in a bipartisan way, even though Republicans did nothing to bring it along. Democrats spent 10 long months hammering this out. And look, it was the conservatives' bill to begin with. It was conservative ideology on paper. But the problem was, old school conservative ideology. This was the, years ago, this was, wow, how dare you bring us something 18 years old, 17 years old? How dare you bring us something that was working in Massachusetts, that liberal tax bastion? And they didn't vote for it. And the idea was to make it better. You know, every year, you know, figure out what was going wrong with it, figure out what we needed to tweak, make it better. Not the GOP. Like the child in the sugary cereal aisle, kicking and screaming that he wanted his Lucky Charms. And only Lucky Charms. No Cheerios. No Bran Flakes. No Raisin Bran. Lucky Charms. Maximum sugar input. They threw their fits. And in came Trump, threw another fit. Kicking and screaming, repeal and replace, repeal and replace, repeal and replace. That's all we heard. That's all we heard. They never told us what they were going to replace it with because they didn't have any clue. Now here's an opportunity. Because what's happened through the Trump years, Donald Trump made the Affordable Care Act pretty damn popular. In fact, this is one of those amazing moments because just earlier this month, the Biden administration announced that the ACA is now covering a record 31 million people. A record. Because it got more popular because you know what? People need it. You need it. We're coming out of a pandemic. Even though Trump did everything he could possibly do to murder it in its sleep. Did everything they could do to smother it with a pillow. Did everything they could do to drag it in the bathtub and drown it. Did everything they could possibly come up with. And they failed. And the question that I keep coming back to is, what are the Republicans going to do now? Because the Affordable Care Act is now polling at really popular rates. Because, you know, even Republicans, don't tell anyone. Don't tell your friends, but there are Republicans who have signed up for the Affordable Care Act. I know, can't believe it. And I'll bet you there's a couple of Trumpers in there who have children who need CHIP, who have family members who need Medicaid, who have family members and who have a whole bunch of family members who are getting Medicare. You know, that evil government insurance. Can we have a moment of sanity? Just for a moment. Can we just go, oh, okay, it's over. The lawsuits are over. There's no more repeal and replace. Can we now have this conversation of going, hey, you know, we need to do something about healthcare? Because the question is, what do we do now? There's no more holding our breath because the ticking bomb is about to go off and 31 million people are going to be stripped of their health care, which is going to throw the entire system of this country into massive chaos. We don't have to worry about that no more. They have defused the bomb. Was it Kiefer Sutherland? Was that the guy on 24? He has come to the rescue and saved us from, well, some of us. We were down to a second left, and thanks to Kiefer, we are now safe. Can we now go, hey, now's the time to let's start talking about what to really do with healthcare. How do we make the Affordable Care Act better? How do we get those complaints that people have? And look, there are some problems with it. First to agree with it. Some problems. Still too high deductibles. Still doesn't cover enough. Still a little too costly. How do we fix that? How do we bring those down? How do we address those concerns? How do we make sure people get the coverage that they need? Can we now go, it's over, please? Will the Republican Party say, you know what? We're 0 for 3, like baseball, 3 strikes, you're out. Can we now go, okay, it's over. Now we've got to do something because the American people want it. It's now legal. And look, you're only losing more. I'm possibly thinking if another one comes, maybe it's going to be an 8-1. And maybe it's going to have to be, they're going to have to do another one. It'll be 9-0. They'll find that last thing that unites the Supreme Court on health care. Question is, where do we go? And, you know, like I said, I'm hoping this is the last bit of it. I'm hoping that we can now admit it's pretty popular. It's now expanding. In fact, I read a thing from the Kaiser Foundation that said, you know, 78% of the people who get the ACA now have 3 or more choices. We're putting choice back into this a little bit because I know how much the right wing loves the idea of choice. He's got the competition in there. Personally, I want one choice. I'll be honest. I want one choice. I want the best choice. I want to make sure that when I get sick, I get taken care of. I want to make sure that if I fall out of the car and break both my knees in a courtyard, I get taken care of and I don't go bankrupt. If my kids get sick, I don't have to worry, are we going to be homeless? Or anyone, you, me, anyone. Can we now start talking about that? Or are we going to have, you know, another couple of years of Republicans going, no, no, we will not have the Affordable Care Act. See, I said during the last guy's years, what he should have done, and I was on board with it. I was 100% on board with it. Make the ACA better. Add a couple of things that we need. Call it Trump Care. Put a big T on it. In fact, you know, get little cards for everyone with a giant T. I was in favor of it. You could have even made it orange and slapped his mug on it, and I would have been okay with that. Maybe even little, you know, gold chains like the whatever that cartoon character Trump they had at that last CPAC convention. Maybe have that with an RFID chip that gives you your information. That to me sounds like I'm on board. I am on board. Sign me up. As long as people get the care they need, as long as our healthcare system is well, good, stable. Because had this been repealed, had we 31 million people lost their health insurance, where do you think they go? They go to the emergency room and the costs begin skyrocketing again. Because before ACA, every person in this country who had employer-sponsored health care or bought their own was paying about $1,000 a year to cover the uninsured. That number has gone down and we've stabilized things. Now look, healthcare costs are going way out of control. We've got to deal with that. But we don't deal with it by kicking 31 million people off of health insurance. We do it by expanding access and economies of scale. Now, one of the things that I like that Bernie Sanders has come out with in this infrastructure bill they're talking about is going further. I would love to see them expand Medicare. I'm a Medicare for all guy, but I'd like to see them expand it. Go to 60, start there, and then move your way down. Give people choice. Give them opportunity. Give people opportunity to get into retirement. Because you know who will thank them? The young people who don't have jobs. And you know who will also thank them? The employers who are paying the health insurance for the older people who want to retire desperately. Seems like a good, reasonable solution, doesn't it? We can get all those old codgers out of those jobs that the young folks need to support their families and begin their lives. Get them into their RVs following Clarence Thomas down the highway as he's getting out of town. Seems like a good idea, doesn't it? That's why we're not going to do it, though. We're not going to do it because it makes sense. It makes a lot of sense. It makes a lot of sense to have one giant insurance pool that everyone is in. And I particularly find it interesting and fun, I guess, on a certain level, when I have people tell me that they don't need health insurance through the government. I talked about this the other day, and it's mind-blowing to me that I hear it. It's kind of like the guy in not too far from me who said, "You keep your government hands off my Medicare." Not really knowing that Medicare is a government program. I had this guy, and I talked about this the other day, who said, I don't need national health care. I don't need health care from my employer because I get TRICARE. And I go, that's great. Good for you. Congratulations. Thank you for your service. We need to take care of our veterans. We need to take care of people that we've promised them the health care. But that's really government-run health care. And he didn't know it was. I go, no, that's universal government health care. The government owns the hospitals. The government pays the doctors. The government does everything. And you're touting how wonderful TRICARE is? While simultaneously saying, no one else can have it? Need to get your ideology straight. Calling, a Medicare for all system socialist while, wait for it, while promoting, advertising, celebrating, and benefiting from a socialist healthcare, a true socialist healthcare program. Please, folks, learn the definitions, get the glossary, open the dictionary, something, but get on the same page so that we can all have the kind of healthcare that when we get sick, when we need help, it's there for us. So I guess my final question on this is, can we now say it's done? Let's move forward. Can we stop holding our breath and make this better so that we all get healthier? We all get the care we need and don't have to worry about going broke. Just my thought. Love to hear yours. You can email me, rick@therickssmithshow.com. Quick break. Right back. Nothing more American than workers standing up, and the union gives a voice.
On the Rick Smith Show.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1913. That was the day the industrial workers of the world led a strike at Studebaker in Detroit. IWW organizers Matilda Rabinowitz, Jack Welch, and others arrived in Detroit to organize. They gave lunchtime speeches outside the auto plant. Their speeches were so popular with Ford workers that managers at the Highland Park plant stopped allowing workers to take their lunches outside and had the organizers arrested. They moved on to try to organize Studebaker, where they had supporters inside. Workers there had complaints similar to those at Ford, namely long hours and endless speed up. At Studebaker, workers were also angry when management changed the way they were paid from weekly to every other week. IWW supporter Dale Schlosser was fired from Studebaker's number 3 plant as he tried to circulate a petition for a return to weekly paydays. Word spread like wildfire, and 3,500 workers walked off the job in the first auto strike in Detroit. Rabinowitz and Walsh led a 7-mile march of thousands to Studebaker plant number 1, and then downtown to Studebaker plant 5, calling workers out on strike. By the end of the day, nearly 6,000 workers speaking a number of different languages voted for IWW representation and put together a list of grievances. IWW organizers envisioned an industry-wide strike, and 2,000 strikers marched to the Packard plant the next day to call those workers out to join the strike. There, they were met and beaten by police. The strike and organizing drive was quickly crushed.
Rabinowitz remarked that workers returning to Studebaker were even more determined to fight. IWW organizer Frank Bond observed the strike was not for a few days or weeks, but maybe 20 or 30 years.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So I came across this story from France. And look, you know, here in the U.S., we're used to attacking unions. We're used to attacking workers and taking their rights away and stealing from their wages. I mean, wage theft and misclassification and theft of workers' comp and unemployment insurance and all of those things. Much, much more costly to working people than all of the stick-em-up holdups, bank robberies, all that stuff in the country. In fact, not just more, but like triple more. So when I see a story of someone in another country wanting to go on off a union leader, I'm like, I should look at this. And we go to France where this company boss said, hey, I'm going to pay 75,000 euros to off this union leader that we don't want them to come and ruin our family atmosphere here. And in fact, you know, the guy agreed. She paid him 75 grand. And then the guy kind of backed off because the person that he was supposed to kill had kids. And good on a murderer hitman for having a conscience and not wanting to kill someone with children. Evidently, they found two other soldiers who were working with the French kind of CIA, who then were arrested and sold the whole thing out. And now we know. And my first thought was, you know, this kind of horrible stuff happens all around the world. And probably here, too. We just don't hear about it because our media won't report on it. But again, I thought interesting. Anyway, here to share some thoughts on the big news of the day. ACA still alive. Yes, Virginia, we will have health care. I've asked our good friend Kevin Gannon to come talk with us. Kevin is the professor of history and the director of the Center for Excellence in Teaching and Learning at Grandview University. Kevin, thanks for taking time for us.
Thanks, Rick. Great to be here with you again.
So yes, Kevin, we have health care. Is this the end of it, do you think? Do you think no more schemes, no more plots, no more assassination attempts, no more ticking bomb of the destruction of healthcare? Is this it, you think?
Well, in a reasonable society, one would probably say yes, but I think we have a lot of evidence to suggest that we don't live in a reasonable society. So who knows, right? I mean, by all rights and purposes, it should be. But, you know, the way that we see the opponents of what they call Obamacare, the way that we see these sort of legal sophists twist their arguments, you know, there's always another bottom, as they say. And those guys are in the bottom of the ditch and they're going to keep digging, I think.
Now, I'm looking at I'm in this moment and I'm paying attention to all the narratives that are being thrown out. Lazy working people who don't want to work because they're getting unemployment, greedy, you know, all this stuff. And, you know, the messaging machine funded by corporate America is unions bad, workers who want more bad, a better life for working people somehow bad. And this, as I said yesterday on the program, not new, yesterday being the 103rd anniversary of Eugene V. Debs' speech from Canton that got him locked up for 10 years for having the audacity to say, no, I think we should not be promoting war. The more things change, the more they stay the same.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm glad you brought up Debs' speech. To give you an idea of how much of a Eugene Debs fanboy I am, my personal identification number for my old bank card, not my current one, but my old bank card was his inmate number when he was in the Atlanta Federal Pen. He was prisoner 9653, and that was my pen for a number of years. So, which is ironic, right? Because that's a functioning of capitalism right there. But, I mean, it just goes to show, you know, as a historian, you know, when you sort of, you know, get a little higher over the landscape and you look at kind of where we are with this narrative as a country, you have all these signs on businesses that'll say, you know, due to a labor shortage, we're closing at 10, you know, which is basically, we don't want to pay people enough to get them to come and work for us. But yet we have this national mythology that people are supposed to put in the hard work and pull themselves up by their bootstraps and improve their station in life. So we say people are supposed to do that. And then we get really pissed at the people who are actually trying to do that. It's a no-win situation for working people. And it's always been a scam, but I don't think that the explicit scamminess has ever been as obvious as it is right now.
Yeah. You know, they tell you, pull yourself up by your bootstraps. The sad reality is production of bootstraps have been moved to China.
Yes.
And when they bring them back, they don't work so well. It's just, you know, more of the cheap plastic crap that we get. But, you know, the thing is, you know, I spend a lot of time talking to young people who are you know, entering the workplace, you know, becoming union members, who know zero about what it took to get the things that they take for granted today, the 8-hour workday, weekends, overtime, safe working conditions, any of those things. And, you know, the education process really has to begin now, because we have fallen down on explaining, you know, what the Debs of the world were fighting for, you know, what the unions of the past, you know, had to go through to just to win what we have now. And things, look, you know, when I first started working, you know, 30 plus years ago, things were better. Working conditions were better. Wages were better. Now it's been this all out assault of the last 40 years that's destroyed that.
Right. And you can track, you know, the decline in sort of what we might call quality of life for the vast majority of Americans with the declining union membership, which tracks in a direct variation with the efforts of the federal government to basically union bust. Right. And that's one of the things that I struggle with as a professor of history when I'm teaching the U.S. history courses is, you know, I get students to come into my class and, you know, we'll talk about Debs and they've never heard of this guy before. And, you know, you don't have to be pro-labor to agree that Eugene Debs is a toweringly important figure in that period of U.S. history. And it just goes to show that, you know, what we have is this sort of sanitized narrative. There's, you know, the emphasis is so much on trying to preserve some sort of consensus in the U.S. about how the past was and what made us the way we are today. And that consensus stands off all of the sharp edges of history. And we're left with this sanitized version that students sort of look at and they say, that doesn't sound right. And I'm not very engaged with it, but I don't know what is right. Right. And so we get these sort of, you know, we get almost this sort of nihilistic skepticism on the part of students. And I do think, you know, there's something to be said for the connection between that and for why we see so much skepticism towards things like expertise today, right? You know, like there is a generation of folks who've come up who have very good reason not to trust what institutions have told them. But the problem is now that we've seen that weaponized, right? And we see people who are distrustful of anything like vaccines, you know, I struggle with this as an educator because, you know, in a position of power, you have to be able to use that power for good.
Right.
And so how do I do that without indoctrinating students? But how do I get students to pick up the tools and build their own understanding themselves? And things like labor and working class history are such a great component for students to be able to do that, because this is what jives with their own experiences.
No, absolutely. And, you know, for a couple of years back, you know, you had shows like Undercover Boss, you know, that presented the CEOs in this caring kind of light, which is ridiculous. And then the show, The Men Who Built America, you know, the titans and captains of industry who did, you know, just horrible things. You never saw the real people who built this country. People like my grandfather and your grandfather and those folks who, you know, bled, sweat and died so that we could have, you know, the buildings and the prosperity that we have.
Yeah. And, you know, the economic prosperity of the United States is literally the product of enslaved labor, you know, the ultimate commodification of the working classes, right? Without the capital that's generated from cotton exports and the textile industry in New England, you don't have the funds that provide what becomes basically the slush money fund for industrialization in the late 19th century. You know, that's the capital. Capital is drawn out of, you know, what we might call the plantation slavery complex. And what's ironic about that is we can't even talk about that today with, you know, the sort of climate against the critical race theory boogeyman and things like that. That, you know, it seems to me that there's a sense on the part of the elites of you know, or those who in whose interest it is to uphold kind of what we would call management, right? There's the sense they have that they are a corner, that the game is almost up. And the way that we see this sort of lashing out against things like whether it's, you know, critical race theory, or whether it's against, you know, these darn millennials who don't want to work for more than $8 an hour, you know, all the various, you know, sort of attacks that we're seeing coming from this sector, I do think that they're related in that way.
No, you're absolutely right. And, you know, I was just having this conversation today with a friend who's my age, and we work in the same industry. And I said, you know, when we started working where we were at, I was on call for 11 years. You know, the phone rings, 2 hours later, I got to be at work. And this generation will have none of that. And I just looked at him, and he was like, can you believe they won't? I go, well, which generation was stupid?
Yeah, right.
Because we put up with it. And I'm going, you know, right. Which generation got it, is getting it right?
Yeah, you hear so much of this, you know, today, like, you know, I can't believe the outrageous things people want. Like in higher education right now, we're wrestling with the fact that for a lot of our staff at colleges and universities, some variation of blending of remote work actually works a lot better for these folks. But then there's that, you know, that inherent managerial distrust that if they're not here where I can see them, then they're not really working, right? Like, these things are so embedded with us. But you have to ask yourself, like, now that some of this stuff has been let out of the bottle, so to speak, you can't put it all back.
Right.
And I agree with you. That's, you know, the terms of the sort of social contract for working people have been violated repeatedly. You know, but now it's, you know, but that's all been on one side of the equation. And now that working people themselves are trying to reclaim some of that agency and control some of the terms of their own work, you know, now we hear this narrative about how society is collapsing. I find that really telling.
Yeah, now that there are workers who have a little bit of power and saying, you know what, we're not going back to the desperate conditions. We're not going back to the poverty wages. And the weird thing is, you know, and I talked about this yesterday on the program, but, you know, I know some union folks who have fallen into that. They're buying the Fox News line. They're saying, you know, these lazy people just need to go back to work. And I'm like, you know, excuse me, having reasonable unemployment should be something we all want so that we're not desperate if it ever happens to us. In fact, what they're getting, the extra little bit, is what it should be anytime you're unemployed.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And what's ironic about all of this, too, you know, all the criticism that's coming from the Fox News and from the right wing is this is basically everything that they say should be working, right? Like, this is what they wanted. They want a complete free market. They want the individual economic actor to make the rational choice that's best for their own self-interest. And for, you know, a 20-something-year-old kid, that's, you know, my rational choice for my own self-interest is I'm not going to take $9.50 to work at Arby's. And now all of a sudden, I'm the one who's ruining society. I did everything that y'all wanted me to do, and now I'm the bad guy. It's just the irony, the layers of irony here are remarkable.
Well, when you start following their ideology, because I have a lot of friends who they believe in the free market. And I'm like, did you not take Economics 101, where they told you that a free market, in order to have a truly free market, you have to be able to abstain? And this is what we're seeing. We're seeing people are going, you know what? Not participating.
Yeah. And it's interesting when you look throughout U.S. history, when we have moments like this where working people have exercised the agency that they've always had, but maybe not really realize the full implications of that agency, you know, but when they do feel, you know, their power and they start to exercise that in ways that we're seeing today and in the decisions that they're making collectively, you know, you can feel the shudder moving through the upper classes of society. I think it may not, you know, it may not seem as dramatic to sort of look at, you know, in terms of who's taking what jobs and things like that. But I do think we're at one of those moments where historians will look back on this period and see it as kind of a watershed moment for the way that work and working people and the role that they play in our society. I do think that the implications of this current moment are really big.
Yeah, I hope I'm around when the studies are written and they look back at this moment, because, you know, the spending that we've done to help folks at the bottom, to ensure that everyone had some income to get through the pandemic, that we help people through when they lost their jobs to be able to not lose everything and end up in worse conditions, which did exactly what conservatives, again, tell us that they believe. When there are less, you know, when there's more demand for workers, the wages go up. That's happening. You know, maybe we'll see something positive out of it.
I think so. And, you know, and COVID really laid bare the fundamental untruth of the sort of Reagan-esque mythology of the job creator. And, you know, workers should be glad to have a situation where they, you know, are paid any wages at all, right? Because it's the entrepreneurs that drive society. And, you know, individual self-interest is what really, you know, lifts all boats. You know, that's a bankrupt, you know, set of ideas. And COVID proved that. You know, we are bound together as a society, and government does have a role to play in this. And working people are the backbone of what generates economic health in our society. We know that now. And so there are a lot of bubbles that got burst over the last year And I think we're really starting to come to grips with that.
Yeah, and I'm hoping,
which I find exciting.
No, I'm with you too. But and I'm hoping at some point, because you had mentioned earlier that we used to listen to people who had expertise. We used to listen to smart people. And look, I don't claim to be the brightest bulb in the box. So I defer to people who I view as intelligent. I hope we go back to that. I hope we stop reading memes on Facebook with our mouth open and going, yep, I'll buy that, as opposed to listening to someone who has spent their life, you know, studying something and giving their thoughts. I hope we return to some bit of critical thinking and critical analysis.
Yeah, and I think the important piece of that is for folks, when I listen to somebody, I should be listening to what they're saying and what their experience with that particular issue is, and not judging what they're saying by, does this person hate the same people I hate? You know, is this person on my team, so to speak? And we all, you know, as human beings, we do have biases towards people that we're more comfortable with, and, you know, and that's fine. But if, you know, truth is defined solely by what team you play for, basically, which is kind of where we are right now. We're in a real, you know, that's a real problem. You know, that's not a healthy society. That's not a functional society. And so I share your hope. But what I also hope for is that what we define as expertise, you know, that the barriers to people acquiring that sort of expertise and experience are lower, and that more people get to share in that journey, and that more people are able to benefit from things like access to better education. Because that, you know, that gets at this idea too. We want a nation of critically informed citizens. You know, and that's the only way to get there is if we're helping people have access to the type of meaningful education that helps shape that.
And then maybe we can begin to look to the past and look at it with clear eyes instead of, well, the people who wrote it to try and make it as nice and as soft and as happy to fit one narrative or the other. Look, I right. don't know much about critical race theory, but I know my you know, middle class, white working class folks that I deal with are adamantly opposed.
Well, you know, and critical race theory has become the boogeyman for basically stuff that makes white people uncomfortable. You know, it's actually kind of boring, you know, when you define it specifically. It comes out of law schools, and the original articulations of what becomes known as critical legal studies basically argues that racism is a collective thing, that you can't just look at individual bad actors. And so when you look at legal outcomes and how come some cases are adjudicated one way and some the other way, that structural racism plays a part. And that's what it says. And you know, we have plenty of empirical evidence to show that, yes, structural racism is a thing, right? But now it's been taken and cynically manipulated into this sort of wedge issue, you know, prime culture war fashion. And in doing so, you know, what it obscures is the, you know, or what it does is it, again, you know, it denies the reality of systems and groups in terms of shaping our society.
And says that, well, we can't. It basically, things keep us stupid, so we don't analyze or ever talk about it, so that we can continue with our bias. It seems that simple to me. Kevin, I appreciate the time, thoughts. Always great having you on the program. I hope you'll come back and share some more with us.
Yeah, thanks, Rick. Always a pleasure to be with you, and keep up the great work.
Thanks so much, our good friend Kevin Gannon. We'll get links out on how you can check out the work that he does. Quick break, right back. Stick around.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
I'm Rick Smith, and this is Labor History in 2. On this day in labor history, the year was 1972. That was the day that 9 firefighters gave their lives in the line of duty in Boston, Massachusetts. The tragedy occurred at the historic Hotel Vendome. Built 100 years earlier, the hotel stood in Boston's Back Bay, one of the most historic neighborhoods in the city. The building was undergoing renovations and being converted into condominiums. A small cafe was open on the first floor, but the rest of the building stood empty due to the construction. On that fateful afternoon, workers noticed smoke. They sounded the alarm, and 100 firefighters rushed to the scene. Within 2 hours, the fire was contained. 3 engines remained for cleanup. Then, without warning, a portion of the building collapsed. 17 firefighters were trapped beneath 2 stories of debris. 9 firemen were killed, leaving behind 8 widows and 23 children. No cause of the fire was ever determined. but it was found that the reason for the collapse was that a support column had been weakened during the renovation. 25 years later, a memorial to these heroes was unveiled, remembering the greatest loss of life in the history of the Boston Fire Department. In 2002, Bruce Springsteen released the song Into the Fire in honor of the firemen who gave their lives on 9/11. It's a song that stands tribute to those whose daily work is running towards danger, not away from it.
Dark sea, healing like you be. You lay your hand on me, walk into the darkness of your smoky grave.
Welcome back to the Rick Smith Show. Now, here is Rick Smith.
So, the Supreme Court case that Texas was involved in, shot down in flames, a thank you 7-2 decision by the folks in robes. But that's not going to stop Greg Abbott, the governor of Texas, from wasting more money. Evidently, the Texas governor today announced they're going to spend $250 million as a down payment so they can build the wall. So bad ideas still strong. Bad ideas still strong with the GOP. And this just another one. So the question is, where do we go from here? What was this decision? How good is it? Should we be happy? I'm a little bit happy right now. That's why I've asked Laura Packard to come talk with us. Laura is a stage 4 cancer survivor and the founder of Healthcare Voices. Laura, thanks for taking time for us.
Thank you for having me.
So big deal. Is this a big deal? Let's start there.
Yes, it's a big deal. Today, the Supreme Court ruled against the Republican-backed lawsuit that threatened the entire Affordable Care Act. So not all my ex-lawsuits live in Texas, but at least some of them do.
I love that. I wish I'd have thought of that. That is fantastic. I'll tell you, I was shocked, but I was even more shocked at the 7-2 that Clarence Thomas wasn't holding hands with Samuel Alito. That was the surprise for me.
Well, I think it's important to note that, yes, this was a 7-2 verdict, but it's not that there were 7 supporters of the Affordable Care Act. They punted on this one on a technicality. They said that the people suing had no right to sue. They had no legal standing. So they didn't rule on the merits of the case. They just wiggled their way out of addressing it altogether.
I don't care. They lost. And now we live another day, because in my view, how many of these do you have to lose? To me, you lost 3 times. Stop already. Now let's take what was your ideology, because look, the Affordable Care Act, honestly and truthfully, and this is no lie, this was a conservative Republican idea from the get-go. This is who Republicans were back in the early 90s. This was a Heritage Foundation plan. This was their idea, personal responsibility, everyone in, business-friendly mandate, private companies be part of it. This is them. Why can't they get on board and make it better?
Well, one of the reasons why they're fighting so hard is because how the Affordable Care Act is paid for is taxes on the rich and corporations. So if they ever succeeded, they'd be giving their donors a big fat tax break. And that's why the Republicans are so determined to end the Affordable Care Act, even though it means taking away healthcare from their own constituents.
31 million people, the Biden administration said earlier this month, a record 31 million people signed up for the Affordable Care Act this year. And I didn't see the kind of outreach that they did during the Obama years this year. I know Biden tried a little bit, but, after 4 years of Trump doing literally nothing, that to me is extremely impressive.
Yes. And actually, the Biden administration did spend more money. They are putting more effort into getting the word out. Although, as you know, they've only been in power since mid-January. But they've done a lot with the time that they have. And I think that's one of the reasons why we've seen over a million new signups in this special enrollment period.
Now, for me, I'll be honest, there's some things about the ACA I'm not thrilled with. The high deductible plans have to come down. We've got to make it more affordable. We've got to make access better. There are a bunch of things in there that we need to do. But this is something where if we can now admit, you know what, stop with the scheming, stop with the plotting, stop with the ticking bombs, stop with all that, and let's make it better for everybody. Something we can do. And ultimately, we can lower costs of healthcare by doing smart stuff.
Absolutely. And I would wish that all these elected officials, regardless of their party, would work to help their constituents have healthcare. But it's turned into this partisan battle, even though it shouldn't have been. Republicans get sick, too.
Yeah, I mean, I've always said I'm very lucky and I've been very fortunate throughout all of my working life to have, there's the Cadillac plan and then there's what I have. I have good Teamster union health insurance. When I had my hip replaced back a year and a half ago, it literally cost me $120 out of pocket. And that is it. $20 for the doctor visit, $80 for the hospital stay, and $20 for the physical therapy visit. That's it. I want that for everybody. I want that. That's what we should be striving for. Not these, everyone got to have skin in the game and high deductible, catastrophic plans. No, I want people to have real protection in the moments that they need it so that they don't have to worry about going bankrupt. They don't have to worry about not taking their kids to the doctor because they can't afford it. We need people to get care, and we need it to be affordable, and we need it to not be able to not break the bank. Is that too much to ask?
I agree with you. I mean, these high deductible plans are penny wise and pound foolish, because if somebody doesn't go to the doctor or they don't take their medicine because they can't afford it, it winds up costing everybody so much more in the end. So the savings that people have, the whole skin in the game idea just doesn't work. If you need to see a doctor, you should be able to see a doctor in the richest country in the world. Yeah. Why can't we make that for everybody?
No, I needed the hip replaced for 10 years. I held off 10 years. 10 years ago, they said, you should get this replaced. I'm like, no, I'll be fine. Literally, he said, yeah, you'll be back eventually. It took me 10 years to go back. It's not like people go rushing to the doctor to have procedures because, I like it. I mean, there might be one. But I don't think the mass of people, I think most people are like me, we'll hold off as long as we can. But when I needed it, I was grateful that it wasn't the end of my world. If I had a heart attack mm-hmm. tomorrow, I'm not laying on the ground speed dialing looking for who's got the coupon for heart attacks this week.
Exactly. I didn't go through 6 months of chemo for funsies.
Yeah. And I can't tell you how many people I've met over the years who the ACA has literally saved their life. And I remember, within 6 months after the ACA passed, we were doing an event and this couple came over and they said, we would have never gone to the doctor. And, we went to that visit and they found this lump, and that lump turned out to be cancerous and basically saved my husband's life and only cost a couple $100 or a couple $1,000 to get done. And you go, this is what we should be doing more of.
Exactly. And it's a matter of choices. We can choose to live in a country, in a system where billionaires put yachts inside yachts, or we can live in a country where everybody gets the health care they need. It's a matter of choice.
So now where do we go? Now that this is, you say it's off on a technicality, maybe there's going to be another lawsuit. Maybe Texas has got unlimited resources to bring another one. I think they're going to keep going after the wall. Who knows? But where do you see this going from here? Do you see another challenge, or do you think that for now states are going to go, the Supreme Court, the Trump Supreme Court doesn't seem quite interested in undoing what Congress couldn't do? Do you see more coming? Do you see it finally dying down and maybe we start talking about how to expand and make it better? Do you see that happening?
Well, I would have thought that after there was a violent insurrection and attempt to overthrow our country, that some Republicans would maybe take a good look at their own party and figure out whether they believe in democracy and a future in America, or whether they believe in something else. But that is not the world we live in. Even despite a trail of destruction, several years and hundreds of thousands of lives long, they just doubled down on it. So I don't think that this particular lawsuit will come back the way that it was dismissed by the Supreme Court without standing. But that doesn't mean they won't find something else, because as long as there are people in power that have turned this into a crusade, they'll keep going. They'll just find a different battlefield.
Yeah, stupid me for thinking that, you know, this might be it. This might be the epiphany of going, you know what, we lost. Baseball, there's that three strikes and you're out thing. Maybe this is the end. But you're right. You know, I doubt they will stop. Now, from the other side, from folks who need the Affordable Care Act, what's the marching order going forward? Because I do want to make this better. I do want to make sure that we have options for people who need this. What's the marching order forward from here then?
Well, President Biden's already done some great work with the American Rescue Plan, passing subsidies to make Affordable Care Act insurance more affordable for many more Americans. But that's only for 2 years. So part of the American Families Plan, one of his infrastructure bills, is to make that help permanent. So we need to pass that. And we also need to work on the costs of healthcare in general. I live in Colorado, and our state legislature just passed the Colorado option to have a more affordable health insurance option for Coloradans. And Nevada did something similar in their legislature. So we're seeing states start to tinker with the public option, and we need to keep working on the national level. Although, as you know, with only 50 votes in the Senate, it gets hard.
Yeah. Do you think this is a moment where maybe we return to the idea of community hospitals? When I was a kid, the hospitals were owned by the people. We had community. I was born in a community hospital. Most of the hospitals I knew were, nonprofits. They were funded by the taxpayer, by the local base. It's only been the last, 20, 30 years that we now have this, for-profit healthcare system that sprung up to feed Wall Street, to feed investors, and to make huge profits for our billionaire class. Do you think this is a moment where states and communities reclaim that infrastructure and, create their own systems to get away from, these massive insurance companies and these greed monsters?
I would hope so. But just like with for-profit prisons, once somebody is making money off of you, they have a lot of money to pay politicians to ignore it. So we've seen the transition of nonprofit health insurance companies into for-profit companies that then give their CEOs billions upon millions and billions of dollars. And we've also seen more recently these venture capital firms, these private equity firms are buying up doctors' offices and private practices and so on, and then jacking up the rates because, Goldman Sachs is more than happy to make a buck off of your suffering if they possibly can. So that's a problem, is now there are more and more entities across our healthcare system that are profiting off of people's misery. And then they're using part of their profits to entrench themselves in the system and buy off people that might regulate them.
Yeah, no more coming in with a chicken to pay the doctor. no more eggs for care. No more bartering. We want cold, hard cash and lots of it. The barter thing's been gone for a long, long time. But you're right. I mean, I had a doctor for years here where I live who had his own office. They had a lot of patients, but just like a 2-3 doctor office. Got bought up by one of the giant conglomerates, and now it's a machine. As we were before, mm-hmm. He would sit and talk with you, and you really got to know him, and I trust him to this day. Now it's a machine, we're on the mm-hmm. clock. And in fact, they got someone trailing him to keep tabs on you and him, basically being the stenographer in the doctor's office. It's really weird, and I don't like it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, just look at good old Senator Rick Scott, who made his for-profit healthcare company made millions off of Medicare fraud, and he's a U.S. senator. So it's
who said
just
crime
disgusting.
Doesn't pay?
Crime paid very well for him.
Crazy. I wanted to get your thoughts on the Sanders idea of moving Medicare down to age 60. I've said it before. I'm a single payer guy. I don't shy away from that. Even though I do have the best health care that money can buy. In fact, I have health care that, you know, a private citizen, small business owner could never get, not even get, no matter how much they spend. And I'm still willing to go, you know what, let's look at something that gets everybody the kind of access that I have. I think lowering the Medicare age is a first start, but I wanted to get your thoughts.
I agree in that just in the battles in Nevada and Colorado to pass small reform this year, the Colorado option bill was, I heard, the most lobbied against bill in Colorado history. Just millions upon millions of dollars that the hospitals and the insurance companies dumped into Colorado to fight reform. So a single payer system means taking on the insurance companies and the hospitals and providers and pharma and all of that all at once. And that is a very tough battle to win. But if you can eat your elephant bite by bite, you're more likely to get there.
Yeah, that's a big bite. It really is. But at the end of the day, this is one of those things that, when you talk about the legacy that generations have left their children and their grandchildren, making sure health security is something that they have, I think is something that I would like to leave the future. My grandparents left us sound infrastructure, a solid economy with strong unions. We squandered that. There's got to be something going forward that we leave to the future.
Right. I mean, we pay one of the most out of any other industrialized nation, and the results we get are middling at best, and that's not sustainable.
Yeah, but we love our employer sponsored healthcare, though, Laura. We love our employer sponsored healthcare. At least that's what we're told. Is that actually true? Now, look, I do like my healthcare. I'll be honest with you, but the company pays for it, the union administers it, and we as a union demand the best healthcare we can get. So we the customers have say over what we get. It's not like that everywhere else. But everybody I talk to in the private sector, they're like, yeah, the premiums are going up, the deductibles are going up, the coinsurance is going up. I'm going, but you pay a deductible, you pay a premium and a coinsurance. What the hell is that? And it's crazy what they've been able to get away with.
Mm-hmm. And before I started, going into business for myself, I worked for a bunch of different small companies. And every year, often they would change insurance and I would lose access to my doctor. And every year it costs more and they would cover less. In the time before the Affordable Care Act, the essential health benefits were not included. So things like birth control, you might not get because maybe your company went with a Catholic health plan because it was cheaper. So all of the things that we may have taken for granted in the last few years under the Affordable Care Act were under threat. And it's unconscionable that Republicans would continue to wage this war against our healthcare.
No, I'm right there with you. Laura, I appreciate the time. I appreciate the expertise. Today is a good day. Even though it was a technicality, still, I'm going with the good day.
Yes, today was a good day. Just don't assume that they're done because Wile E. Coyote never gives up.
Yeah, that there is truth right there. Laura, I appreciate the time. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Good stuff, Laura Packard. Make sure to check out her website, laurapackard.com. We'll get links out on social media how you can do that. But like we said, it's a good day. It's a good day. Let's take a quick break right back after this. Stick around. You're listening to The Rick Smith Show. We're working people. Come to talk.
Remembering that united we bargain, divided we beg. Rick Smith.
Hello, I'm David Filman, Executive Director of AFSCME Council 13, the American Federation of State, County, and Municipal Employees. A union of over 1.4 million strong and growing, AFSCME is gaining improvements in the workplace all across America. And right here in the Commonwealth, more than 95,000 AFSCME members make Pennsylvania happen. Highways, libraries, hospitals, parks, offices, prisons, classrooms, museums, courtrooms. You'll find AFSCME members at work in all these places and many more.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
I make Pennsylvania happen every day.
Today's AFSCME members take on public service jobs as diverse as they are, not for the recognition, but for a better Pennsylvania. For more information, please visit our website at AFSCME13.org. Labor is changing. So is your labor union. We are AFSCME.